Everyone else had drunk Victor's Polish vodka, but I'd stuck with a little too much of it and I felt terrible. I drank a big glass of water before my shower and another after, and then it was time to go to Jamie's. She was throwing a going-away brunch for Christine that morning. Christine was moving to Boston for graduate school, and although it seemed wrong for us to gather without Mike, we had to observe the occasion somehow. Moving to Boston, I envied her. Jamie had a typical Mifflin dining room, with a pass-through to the kitchen, a bay window looking into the side yard, and a wall of built-ins. In this case, a bank of drawers below a pair of glass-fronted cabinets that had been painted so often they no longer closed all the way. Jamie's parents had contributed an ancient dining room set they'd inherited from Jamie's grandmother, and once everyone arrived, we settled into the heavy dark wood chairs. Jamie at one end, Rooster at the other, and Bill and Christine opposite me and Stu. Bill reached over and put a hand on Christine's shoulder. They'd broken up and gone back together so many times, even they'd lost count, but now that she was leaving, he seemed really sad. Spotting them coming up the walk earlier, Jamie had said, "The Beeve looks grieved." He was good-looking, dark and lanky, with a sexy silver stud in one earlobe, but he had buck teeth. Rooster finally pushed back from the table. He stretched his legs to the side and patted his stomach. "The spare tire Spartans," he said. "Just like Mike said, I'll go on a diet when he wakes up." We all looked down for a moment, all of us but Rooster, who in the angry way he was looking at me when I looked up again told me what I already knew, that we were failing Mike by not talking about him. It was almost 3:30 and we'd been sitting for a long time. Jamie stood up and began to clear, and I stretched my arms over my head and yawned, then rose to help her. "Let's do something," I said to Jamie in the kitchen. "All of us. Go rent sailboards or play volleyball or something." "Make like a beer commercial? I could get into that." We started back out to where the others were, but the phone rang just as we reached the doorway. "Go ahead," Jamie said. "I'll be right there. I vote sailboards." I found them sitting in silence, all looking stupefied. "Perk up, guys," I said. But then Jamie was gripping my arm. "It's for you," she said. "The phone. Mrs. Mayer." Mike had woken up, and now I cried freely. I cried when I hung up the phone, I cried when I felt Jamie's arms around me, and I cried as everyone came into the kitchen and hugged me, Rooster tightest of all. After Mike dove, the circles on the reservoir had widened exactly in time with my growing sense that something was terribly wrong. The relief I felt now was explosive, like the sudden surfacing of someone from underwater, sprays shooting everywhere. Rooster drove me to the hospital, and I kept crying, leaning against the window and looking out at the quiet day. "It's okay," Mrs. Mayer said when we'd arrived at the intensive care lounge, and I'd flung myself into her arms, so glad he'd woken, so glad I was glad. "It's okay." When we were allowed in, the Mayers told me I could go alone if I wanted, or with Rooster, but I wanted Mrs. Mayer with me. Mike lay on his back, no change apparent from my previous visit. The ventilator whooshed and sighed, whooshed and sighed. His arms and legs were heavy and pale, and his eyes were closed. "He's sleeping," Mrs. Mayer whispered. "It's normal." I nodded. "We're going to turn the den into a bedroom for him," she said. "Because of the stairs." I felt new tears stream down my face, and without looking at me, she took my hand. "There's the TV already in there, and we'll hook up his stereo, too. Maybe we'll have to build a new bathroom. His dad thinks we should wait and see, but we have to be ready before Michael is." "That's true," I said. "Mike," she said. "Michael." At first, I thought I was imagining it. But his eyelids fluttered a little and then opened. He looked straight at me, his gray eyes surprisingly clear. Could he see me? See anything? His eyes closed again, and he slept. For the next several days, I went to the hospital whenever I could, before work, after work, sometimes almost guiltlessly during work, explaining to Miss Grafton that I'd be right back and then vanishing for an hour. Sometimes he never opened his eyes while I was there, but on others he seemed quite alert, seemed to recognize me. I began to talk to him, just, "Mike, it's me, and I love you, and everything's gonna be okay." The doctors tested him. They searched for sensation and motion, for reflexes, but below the chest it was as if he were dead. "At least the injury happened at the lower part of the cervical spine," one doctor said. "At least he'll be able to breathe on his own." And it was true, although I felt there was some faulty logic in being glad about any of it. The word quadriplegic encompassed situations that were far worse than Mike's. "Think of it this way," said another doctor. "With an injury at the C5-6 level, he's technically a quadriplegic, but he'll function like a paraplegic without hands." I understood what he meant, that Mike would be able to use his shoulders and upper arms, that with mechanical devices strapped to his forearms, he'd be able to manipulate things. But I couldn't banish the gruesome image. Mike with his hands chopped off, blood pouring from the stumps. "You hurt yourself," we told him. "Remember the reservoir. You dove and hit your head." It was terrible to see the anguish on his face. Terrible not to know how much he understood. The breathing tube prevented him from speaking, so even once he was more alert, he couldn't ask questions. Finally, the mayors decided he had to hear it all, a full description of the accident and what it had done to him. We agreed that I would wait in the lounge, then go in afterward. Visiting hours hadn't officially started yet, and I had the place to myself. Finally, the neurosurgeon, Dr. Spellman, strode past, heading for Mike's room, and I understood that at that moment Mike knew. The mayors had asked the doctor to let them tell Mike what he'd lost, but they wanted him to explain how Mike might be able to get a little of it back. Surgery to fuse his cervical spine, and then months and months of in-hospital rehab. The idea of Mike lying there, knowing. My eyes filled, and I stood up and began pacing, fighting hard not to cry again. A little later, Dr. Spellman appeared at the entrance to the lounge. He came in and looked at me uncertainly, then suggested we sit down. "I've just been with Mike," he said. "He's very strong, your boyfriend. We're going to move ahead on the cervical fusion." He paused, and I wondered why he'd come in to talk to me. We'd never spoken privately before, and I was surprised he even knew who I was. "I'm glad I saw you in here," he continued. "It's premature to think too far ahead, but here you are, so I'll break my own rule. You're the person Mike seems most concerned about, most aware of. The nurses have noticed that he's a lot more alert after your visits than after his parents, say. And just now he seemed to want to know where you were." "We're engaged," I said. "Except that everything's changed now, although that can be hard to keep in sight sometimes. I'd counsel you to go very gently these next few months. Rehab is very hard work. A lot of getting better is wanting to." He stood up and cleared his throat, and I felt my face burning. My fingers were actually shaking. As he walked away, I imagined my own outraged voice calling after him. "You don't know a thing about me," it said. "Not one single thing." I stood up and headed for Mike's room. Just outside, I paused for a moment and looked in. Mrs. Mayer stood at the foot of Mike's bed, looking flushed but composed. But Mr. Mayer was weeping, sitting in the one chair, his glasses askew in his lap, his big hands cupped over his eyes. I stepped in and they all looked at me. Immediately, Mike began blinking furiously, and I squeezed past Mr. Mayer and stood over him. "I'm sorry," he mouthed. His gray eyes were hard on me, moving over my face, looking and looking for where I was now. Where, given what had happened to him? Where, given the months beforehand? "Forget all of that," I longed to say, but not in front of his parents. And how to retract something I'd never spoken in the first place? Remorse boiled through me, but I could not dwell on it now. I stepped forward and touched his forearm, then moved my fingers around to where he had some sensation. I stroked his skin. "Don't worry," I said. "I love you, don't worry." And grateful relief filled his pale face, coloring his cheeks and outlining his dry lips. The day of the surgery arrived. For movies and TV, I had an image of efficient bustle, all those people in masks and gowns. That fell apart when I heard Mr. Mayer talking about whether they'd go in from the front of Mike's neck or the back. Knives cutting him open, his blood spilling. It was unbearable. "Don't touch him!" I wanted to shriek. We had one last vigil, this time near the OR. The Mayer's rooster and I. Finally, after almost 3 hours, Dr. Spellman came in and said, "It's over. Everything went smoothly. He's in recovery." And we bowed our heads and wept, each one of us. Only one person was allowed in, and his mother insisted, so it was the next morning before I could see him. He lay flat on his back, his head encircled by a steel band that had been attached to his skull with screws. Taut struts joined the band to a bulky sheepskin vest he wore. "Oh my God," I heard myself say. Mr. and Mrs. Mayer were nowhere to be seen, but Julia and John Jr. were there, and they turned at the sound of my voice, exactly as Mike's eyes found me. "That's the halo," Julie said flatly. "The halo, the device to keep his neck from moving post-surgery." Somehow I'd expected something less medieval-looking, something more like a halo. "Hi," I said, and as I moved closer to him, I felt something falter in me, some kind of courage or resolve. He looked somber, his face full of shadows. "How," I said, I, my mouth was like cotton. "How do you feel?" He licked his lips. "My head hurts," he said hoarsely. I nodded, and it was a moment before I realized. He had spoken. The tube into his throat was gone. The ventilator was off, its hiss extinguished. "You're talking," I said. "You're off the ventilator." He didn't answer, and Julie said, "They're weaning him off of it, a little at a time." In a few minutes, a nurse I'd never really talked to came in. She had an angry look on her face. "What are you doing?" she demanded, and for a second I wasn't sure whom she was addressing. She was looking straight at Mike. "One of you has to go. Now." I turned to Mike and smiled. "I'll come back later, okay? In a few hours." "Don't go." Julie picked up her purse. "We'll go." She adjusted the strap on her shoulder and looked meaningfully at John. "Mom and Dad will be back soon, Mike, okay?" John followed after her. I looked at the screws going into Mike's head, then quickly looked away. It was important to talk to him, but what could I say? He made a noise in his throat, as if he were trying to clear it, but couldn't very well. "Could you kiss me?" he said. I was stunned. "I wish you would kiss me," he went on. "Gary." And it was only then, when he said my name, that the real long missing sound of his voice finally reached me, his distinctive low voice, which had been silent so long. Tears streamed from my eyes. How was it that I hadn't thought about his voice at all, hadn't missed it? He was waiting, and I wiped the tears away with the sides of my forefingers, then dried my hands on my pants. I lowered my face, but then stopped, unsure how to avoid the halo. What would happen if I touched it? Would it hurt him? Slowly, carefully, I pressed my mouth to his cheek, then pulled away. He had pursed his lips and was holding them together. He stared into my eyes until I bent again and pressed my lips to his. I was about to straighten up when I felt his tongue against my mouth, soft and warm, and infinitely familiar. 4 days later, Mike started rehab, and suddenly everything was different. Here the nurses wore pantsuits and were brisk and businesslike, even a bit military. "Let's go," they'd say, and there'd be no time for protests. They'd have you going, whether it was into your wheelchair, onto your other side, or up to eat. Rehab was exhausting. Sometimes Mike seemed so overwhelmed he couldn't even talk. He'd just lie there while we chatted with each other, his face drawn with fatigue. I slipped into despair. I couldn't help it. He was never going to walk again. He was going to live life from a wheelchair, watch life from a wheelchair. I showed up to visit, but it was hard for me to talk, hard to smile. I did talk, I did smile, but I felt fake. At home afterward, I sat still for hours sometimes, or I sewed. The Saturday of paddle and portage came, and Jamie arranged for us to meet Rooster and Stew there. I had no desire to go, but I also had no desire not to, so I agreed. She picked me up at my apartment and we walked over to James Madison Park. Paddle and portage was a Madison tradition, a yearly canoe-come-foot race that drew competitors from all over the Midwest, serious athletes and weekend runners, hundreds of people ready to paddle halfway across Lake Mendota and back, then to run carrying their canoes up the hill halfway around the Capitol and down the other side, and finally to paddle another course on Lake Monona. Rooster and Stew had staked out a picnic table. The park was beyond crowded, all the contestants plus the observers, bikes tangled against trees. A voice over the loudspeaker announced that the first heat was about to go, and Jamie and I climbed onto the picnic table so we could see. A gunshot sounded and the canoes hit the water, 30 or 40 of them, their destination a sailboat anchored off Picnic Point. We watched them moving across the water, but after a while it got hard to see who was winning, and soon even to know who was still heading away and who had already turned back. "Why do I forget binoculars every year?" Stu said. "Why do I come every year?" Jamie countered. She climbed down and sat on the table, her feet on the bench. After a moment I sat too, fanning myself against the heat. It was already at least 90. "I'm bored," Jamie said. "Let's do something. Let's go to Chicago." "What, now?" I'd been planning to head for the hospital after the race. Jamie shrugged. "Why not?" Stu laced his fingers and stretched his arms over his head. "It's not a bad idea," he said. 3 hours in an air-conditioned car sounds good no matter what's on the other end." "I don't think so," Rooster said. "Why not?" Jamie cried. "I have a date." "A date?" Stu said. "Call the papers, it's a miracle." "Shut up," Rooster said, but he was smiling suddenly, his teeth white against the pink of his face. Jamie leaned forward. "With?" "Joan," he said. I looked at Jamie, then Stu. "Nurse Joan," I said. "From intensive care?" He nodded. I couldn't believe it. Joan had to be at least 30, and then there were her looks. That fragile, pale skin and her long blonde hair and her height. Rooster's usual date was the kind of girl who'd be cast as the loyal best friend in a movie. Not exactly pretty, but spunky, and with a bit of a mouth, which was where things generally went wrong as far as Rooster was concerned. Actually, his usual date was no one. People around us moved toward the shoreline, yelling and cheering, and Jamie and I climbed back onto the table to see over the crowd. "Mike and I were going to do it this year," Rooster said suddenly. "We were going to surprise you guys." I looked down at him. "What?" he said. "We were. You know, Mike, the man with a plan. He made a training schedule for us. He had the whole thing figured out. We were going to buy a used canoe as soon as the lake thawed." "So why didn't you?" Stu said. Rooster stared at me. "Mike dropped the idea," he said.
"He just dropped it?" Stu said.
"That doesn't sound like Mike." I think there was something else on his mind. I think he was actually really worried about something. My face filled with heat. This could not be happening. After a moment, I got off the table and walked away. Free of the crowd, I stopped and leaned against a tree. I looked out at the lake, Picnic Point across the water, the anchored sailboat that marked the turning around point of the race. "He's sorry," Jamie said. She'd come to stand in front of me. "He really is, Care. Look at him." Rooster was sitting at the table now, his forehead resting on his palms. "Let's do something tonight," she said. "Go to a girl movie and then stop off somewhere for huge, disgusting Sundays. After you visit Mike, what do you say?"
"I don't think so."
Small lines appeared by the sides of her mouth.
"Well, will you come and watch the end of the race with me? Without those guys?"
I reached for her hand and laced my fingers between hers.
"I can't," I said. "I really can't. Just go with them, okay? And I'll call you tomorrow."
She frowned and looked away. "First thing tomorrow," I said. "I promise." Once they'd left, I went back to the picnic table and sat down. I watched the end of the first heat and then the beginning of the second. A guy was coming toward me with a cautiously friendly look on his face, as if he thought he knew me but wasn't sure. He had light brown hair and wire-framed glasses and wore a retro shirt, burgundy and cream nylon in wide vertical stripes.
"Carrie? Carrie Bell?"
I nodded and he gave me a wide smile.
"It's Simon Rhodes, from Mrs. Erickson's French class in 12th grade."
I clapped my hand to my mouth.
"I am so sorry. Simon, you look totally different. You look great," I added, and he laughed before I had time to be embarrassed.
"I look human. I decided to sacrifice my beauteous locks for a more up-to-date look." At 17, he'd hidden behind a curtain of hair. He sat a few rows over from me, spent whole class periods doodling in a notebook. "What's up?" I said to him now. "How are you? Do you still live in Madison?" He shook his head. "New York, I'm visiting the Rents." He turned and watched a couple of middle-aged men trudge by with a canoe.
"So tell me," he said. "Whatever happened to Carrie Bell? Are you still in touch with Jamie Fletcher? I seem to recall a certain inseparableness."
"She was just here," I said.
"And Mike Mayer, cutest couple in the senior class?"
I blushed. Even then, it had made me cringe. The yearbook staff had made us pose for a picture, and it was the only picture of the two of us I didn't like, holding hands and looking moony. Mike thought it made us both look retarded. "We're engaged," I told Simon.
"When's the happy day?"
I looked at the lake. "Mike's in the hospital. He was in a diving accident 6 weeks ago and he broke his neck."
"Oh my God," Simon said.
"I am so sorry."
"Thanks."
We stood there without saying any more for what seemed like an age.
"I should get going," I said.
"Are you on foot?" He hesitated, the look on his face saying he didn't want to intrude. "We could walk together."
"Okay,"
I said, though I didn't know where we'd go or what we'd say or why I was agreeing. We wound up walking to campus.
"So, where'd you go to college?" I said.
He looked embarrassed.
"Yale."
"Excuse me." At least I didn't say a little school in Connecticut as certain of my acquaintances had been known to do. At least there's that. We both smiled and he tipped his head toward the building we were passing. "You want here?"
"Alas."
"Were you in a sorority?" "Please, I would have had to dye my hair blonde and had half my brain cells surgically removed. Actually, Mike rushed, but then at the last minute he pulled out. His dad was really into it, but Mike realized he'd be living with a bunch of guys out of Animal House, and he decided no way. He lived at home all 4 years."
"I'm always doing that," Simon said.
"Rushing around and then changing my mind about all kinds of guys."
I studied him, his face still and serious.
"Are you gay?" He nodded.
"Are you out?"
"You mean with my parents?" He grinned. "I broke the news last summer right after graduation. Thanks for flying all the way out here, Mom and Dad. Oh, by the way, I'm gay. Actually, it doesn't seem to bother them much." We found a shady table on the Union Terrace, and we sat and talked, through 2 cups of coffee each, and then sandwiches, and then ice cream cones. I found myself telling him more than I'd told anyone else, about my slow cooling toward Mike before the accident, my horrible numbness afterward, the despair I felt now.
"What are you going to do?" Simon said.
"What do you mean?" I asked, though I knew. Was I going to be strong and good? And devote myself to Mike, or wasn't I?
"I don't know," I told Simon.
He shook his head.
I can't even imagine. You must be in such pain. I nodded and tears stung at my eyes, but rather than look away, he continued to look at me, his face full of compassion. I hope you don't think this is weird, he said, but I'm really glad I ran into you today. I am too. We'd been sitting for hours and it was obviously time to leave. We pushed back from our table and strolled through the union, then said goodbye out front. I felt open and elevated, more like the person I wanted to be than I'd felt in months. It was after 3, past time for me to visit Mike. I started toward home. I could read, take a shower, eat the watermelon I'd bought the day before, sit outside when my porch fell into shade. The day would go by whether I went to the hospital or not. I had desk duty at the library on Monday. It was the most boring part of my job, and I usually had a crossword puzzle to work on when no one was looking, or a magazine tucked into a partly closed drawer. Today it was a magazine. I was reading covertly and keeping an eye on the closed door behind which Miss Grafton sat when Rooster came in at a little after 12:30. He marched over and said, "We have to talk." I glanced around and put a finger to my lips. "Don't shush me," he said evenly. "I drove all the way up here. Just walk out into the hall with me." I got my purse from the staff room and headed for the door. Several paces ahead of me, Rooster led the way down to the ground floor and out of the library, not looking back once. Finally, he stopped and leaned against the building. We were on a wide, empty plaza, the sun blazing down. "Listen, Carrie," he began, "we go way back and we've always got along pretty good, right? I mean, none of this my best friend's girlfriend shit, right?" I nodded, although I had no idea what he meant. "So excuse me when I say you have to try harder." "What are you talking about?" His eyes widened. "What am I talking about? I'm talking about Mike. Jesus fucking Christ, Carrie." He threw up his hands in disgust. "When was the last time you were at the hospital?" The answer was Friday. After skipping Saturday, it had been all too, what, easy, maybe, or inevitable to skip yesterday, too? "I know when," he said. "Why didn't you go yesterday? Why didn't you go Saturday?" "Because I didn't feel like it." His mouth tightened. "You think I felt like it? You think Mrs. Mayer felt like seeing her son with his head in a fucking cage? No one feels like it. You go anyway. That's what love means." "Oh, really?" I said. "I thought it meant never having to say you're sorry." He turned and slammed the edge of his fist against the wall. "I can't get through to you. You're some cold woman, Carrie Bell. You're ice. Mike's well clear of you. That's what I think. Well clear of you. Just do it, okay? Don't keep him hanging." I went straight to the hospital after that, and for the next 4 days I spoke to no one but Mike and Mrs. Mayer, skipping work without so much as calling in sick. Visiting hours were much looser in rehab, and I just hung out during the day, before Mike's other visitors arrived. Hung out, watched his sessions, stayed out of the way when I had to, kept him company when he was back in bed. At home I let my answering machine do all the work. Jamie called my mother, Victor, Miss Grafton, even Rooster once, his voice high and strained as he apologized, begging me to call him. I left the volume up so I could listen, but I never picked up. I was across the room at the table where I sat, sewing and sewing. My refuge after the hospital, my antidote. I made 2 skirts that week and decided this, that my next project would be something silk. I didn't know what. I had savings. I'd been sewing for 11 years, and it was about time I made something silk. On Friday night, the phone rang and I heard the machine click on. After the beep, I heard a male voice. It took me a moment to recognize as Simon Rhodes. "Hi, Carrie," he said. "I'm leaving tomorrow and I was hoping maybe you'd be free for a drink." I crossed the room and picked up the phone. "You're there," he said. "Great. Can you go out for a drink?" I half wanted to, but I didn't feel like running into anyone. I told him about my week, explaining it to him more satisfying than I would have dreamed. We talked for 10 or 15 minutes, and finally I suggested we have the drink at my place so we could keep talking without my having to brave the world again. I gave him the address and hung up, and the phone rang again instantly. "Carrie, I know you're there. I've been getting a busy signal for the last 5 minutes, so I know you're there. What's going on? Why haven't you called me back? I left like 20 messages on this stupid machine. Pick up. It was Jamie. I so much didn't want to talk to her at that moment that it felt visceral, like a physical aversion. Okay, I'm coming over, she said. I'll be there in 10 minutes. I crossed the room and forced myself to pick up the receiver. Hi.
What is going on? She exclaimed. Everyone's worried sick about you. I just talked to your mom and she's having a cow. She'll probably pull up outside your house any minute now. Victor called her tonight and told her you haven't been at work since Monday.
Well, I haven't, I said. So what?
So what? Are you sick? Is it because of Rooster going to the library on Monday?
I've just been out of circulation for a few days, I said at last. Relax. She was silent. When she spoke again, her voice was quiet, controlled. Should I come over? I felt a wave of disgust. No, thanks. I heard her sigh and I said, I'm fine, Jamie, I am. But thanks. I'm worried about you, she said. I really am. I tried calling my mother after that, but I got her machine, so I went outside and sat on my upstairs porch and waited, watching the night fall fast from the trees. I didn't know who would arrive first, Simon or my mother, and I thought that it didn't really matter. Down on the street, my mother's car pulled up and stopped, and I stood. When she opened the door, the inside light illuminated her narrow figure and the speed with which she was moving, and for a moment I felt hot and tearful, a heavy storm of feeling gathering around me. Then the car door closed, and I moved to the edge of the porch and called hello. She stopped and looked up.
Honey?
Hi.
Is everything okay? Are you sick?
I'm fine.
I heard you hadn't been at work, and I was worried.
When she came upstairs, I saw that she was still in her work clothes, a two-piece beige linen dress over brown suede pumps.
I've called you a couple of times, she said. Is your machine working?
I nodded. I'm sorry, I was going to call you tonight.
Why no work, hon? Can you tell me?
I don't like my job. I don't want to work there anymore. My heart pounded. The idea had come out of nowhere, but once I said it, I knew it was true.
Quit,
she said. I might. The doorbell rang then, and our heads turned in unison toward the stairway.
Who's that? She said. Are you expecting someone?
There was a touch of something in her voice that I thought just might be hopefulness. It's Simon Rhodes, I said. A friend from high school. I started down to let him in, but then I saw him through the glass door, a bunch of pale roses in hand, and I felt the heavy storm again, moving in quickly. Hey, don't, he said as I opened the door. They're just for my mother's garden. Hey, hey. My mother's upstairs, I sobbed. He shrugged, pressing the flowers into my hands. That's okay, he said. That's fine. Does she feel like having a drink?
Later, he and I sat outside on my porch sipping vodka and tonics,
the only illumination a citronella candle that wasn't doing much to keep the mosquitoes away. My mother had left shortly after his arrival. So, you're going back to New York tomorrow, I said. What's it like there, in five words or less? Huge, filthy, and wonderful. That's four.
Is it really romantic and glamorous? Do you go out for dinner at amazing restaurants all the time, you and your boyfriend? I mean, when you're together.
On the Union Terrace, he told me an on-again, off-again story to rival Christine and Bill's. His saga, he'd called it.
When we're together, he said theatrically, everything is amazing. Then he sort of snorted.
Actually, when we're together having Chinese food around the corner from his apartment and then going to a movie is pretty much our standard. Sorry to disappoint you.
I shook my head.
Even Chinese food in New York sounded glamorous.
What about you and Mike, he said.
What was it like when you were together? I mean, happily together.
I felt a constriction in my throat. Happily together back in the old days.
What was it like, or what did we do?
Either, both. I picked up my glass and took a sip. We hung out. We played tennis, rode bikes, went out drinking, went to lots of hockey games, saw movies, rented them.
Sometimes we took my laundry to his parents' house.
So what now? He said after a while.
I guess I'll go back to work.
In Madison, winter went on forever. October to May some years, so long it often felt endless. Less winter than Madison itself. Life itself. Spring was a blink of an eye, fall a brief, surprising chill. The hottest summers felt short, no matter how hot, how humid. This one, though, July crept by one scorching day after another. The humidity was unbearable. Leaving the library or the hospital, I thought of the outside air as malevolent. I worked, I visited Mike, and I sewed and sewed. New curtains for my apartment, and then a throw for the foot of his bed. A red and white checked rectangle that I filled with cotton batting and machine quilted. I was at House of Fabric so often, one of the saleswomen started calling me honey. I drifted through my job, so deep into autopilot, Victor started giving me worried looks coming over and jostling my elbow if I stood in one place for too long. After my week away, Miss Grafton had brushed off my apologies, but now she seemed leery of me, stayed a couple of yards away when we had to talk, as if she might catch whatever I had. During the days, Mike wore a sweatsuit, the most comfortable thing for physical therapy, loose and unconstricting. The jacket had long sleeves, and I hadn't seen his bare arms in weeks until I arrived later than usual one evening, after everyone was gone and he'd been changed into short-sleeve pajamas, and found that his forearms had thinned and hardened into the subtle curve of pure bone, with nearly the same paleness. "Hi," I managed at last, and I crossed to the bed and kissed his cheek. "Sorry, I had to work late." He frowned. "You don't have to come every night."
"I want to, you know that."
"I don't know why."
"I love you, could that be it?"
"You loved me. Now you just feel sorry for me."
He stared hard, and I felt he tossed the remark out to see what it would catch, how persuasively I could deny it.
"That's not true," I said.
"One of these days it will be. You think we're going to have a fun life together, you, me, and my wheelchair?"
"Mike, don't." I put my hand on his shoulder. "Really, let's just see what happens, okay?"
"It already has happened. It's over."
My legs went cold.
"Us," I said.
"No, me," he said. "Me, obviously."
Inside a narrow doorway, metal-edged stairs led up to the Stockpot, a crowded three-room cafe that was famous for soup. They served hot chowders and bisques in winter, cool gazpachos in summer. I sat at a table by the window. Anya appeared at the table smiling, her broad shoulders pulling at the sleeves of her black t-shirt. She'd called the night before suggesting lunch, and while I'd been happy to hear from her, I was sure Victor had put her up to it.
"I can't believe how long ago your dinner was," I said once we'd said hello and she'd sat down. "I've been wanting to have you guys over to my place," but she shook her head.
"Please, you have been very occupied. There is no need to apologize. Tell me, how does everything go?" "Victor is a very poor carrier of information. He tells me your friend is moved to a rehabilitation, but not how things are."
"Just the facts, ma'am."
"That's right," she said with a smile. "And the facts are where I want to begin, not end."
She leaned forward and widened her amber eyes.
"Don't you think this is one of the main differences between men and women? Men want the facts," she pounded the table, "and we want what's between them, the interesting air circulating around them."
"The truth," I said. "I guess that's sort of right. Maybe men stick to facts as a way of controlling us. We'd prefer the truth, and they know it, so they withhold themselves from talking things over and analyzing them because it gives them power over us."
She grinned.
"You must come to my women's group. What do you say? You're perfect. You're the neo-feminist. It's every other Tuesday night. We take turns hosting. You must."
"I'm at the hospital every evening," I said. "I really can't. But thanks." She shrugged, and I thought I saw something flicker across her brow. Perhaps the bit of interest she'd had in me as it faded away.
We had just gotten our lunches when Jamie and her mother came into the cafe. Though Jamie'd asked and asked, we hadn't done anything together in weeks. Now here I was with someone else. When we were done, I took Anya over to the Fletcher's table to say hello. Jamie chewed her salad briskly, as if she were so involved with her lunch that it was too much trouble to show an interest.
"My husband is working with Carrie," Anya said by way of explanation, and Jamie nodded offhandedly.
"Victor, I know." Mrs. Fletcher gave me an uneasy smile. She seemed older than she had the last time I'd seen her, softer and more wrinkled. There was something fearful in her shy brown eyes.
"Can you girls sit?"
she said, patting the chair next to her.
"I haven't seen you in so long, Carrie."
Anya looked at her watch.
"I am having to return to work, so I'll say goodbye."
She turned to me.
"Please stay if you like, and thank you for meeting me."
I wanted to walk out with her, but Jamie's eyes bored into me. Instead, I said goodbye and watched her go.
"I've been thinking of you so much," Mrs. Fletcher said. "How are you?"
"I'm okay."
"And Mike?"
"He's working hard," I said. "He's hanging in there." I sat with them while they finished their lunches, and then we all headed outside together. We made our way around the corner to where Mrs. Fletcher's big paneled station wagon was parked.
"Don't be such a stranger," she said to me as she unlocked the door. "You come see me without Jamie sometime."
We watched as her mother drove away, her brake lights flashing hesitantly as she neared the far corner. Finally, she turned and Jamie let out a big sigh.
"Do you think she's on something? Does she talk incredibly slowly, or is it just me?"
I turned and looked her over, the short sleeves of her Cobra Copy t-shirt rolled as high as they'd go, exposing her thin, pale arms.
"What's the matter?" I said.
"What were you doing having lunch with her anyway?" Jamie frowned. "Talking about Lynn. Sullen, I should say." Lynn was Jamie's younger sister. She'd graduated from high school in June and was waitressing at a restaurant on the far west side. No plans to go to college.
"What about her?" I said.
"Her general idiocy. Jamie." She'd been standing with her hands on her hips, and now she flung them to the sides.
"She's like a 13-year-old too dumb to finesse her curfew. Every night, Mom stays awake until she hears Lynn tiptoeing up the stairs. Now she wants me to talk to her."
"Are you going to?"
"Fuck no."
She stared unhappily into the street.
"I wish this fucking summer was over. I wish everything would go back to normal."
"Everything like what?" I stared into her face.
"Like you."
"I can't," I said after a moment.
"You know that."
She turned away. There was nothing to do but make our way back to State Street. We walked side by side without talking. I was done with work for the day, and before she headed toward the copy shop to start her shift, we managed to say goodbye. I turned around and headed up State Street, and after a while I came to Fabrications. It was the only boutique-y fabric store in town, and it had prices to match, but I loved it. Loved going in to wander among the Liberty cottons, to stand in awe before the wall of silks in the back. From the sidewalk, I looked in the window. There was a sleeveless blue dress hanging there, beautifully simple, with a square neckline and a nipped-in waist. The envelope for the pattern had been pinned to one shoulder, a Vogue pattern I'd used once. Through the window, I couldn't really tell what the fabric was like, so I went inside and reached over the display ledge for a touch. It felt like silky tissue paper. I looked at the tag. $40 a yard. A roll of washed silk caught my eye. The color was beautiful, a warm, pale gold like honey in sunlight. I looked up and found a saleswoman watching me.
"Buying or browsing?"
"Maybe both, but I can't decide."
"On the fabric or the pattern?"
"Either."
Smiling, she picked up the roll of washed silk and led me to a full-length mirror.
"Look," she said, unrolling a couple of yards and holding it up in front of me.
"Gorgeous with your dark hair."
It was gorgeous, a sheet of pale gold moving with a subtle luster.
"It feels so good," I said.
It's sexy stuff, she said with a smile.
I made a nightgown out of it for a friend who was getting married, and she was pregnant before the end of her honeymoon.
A nightgown. A silk nightgown. With spaghetti straps, and over it a long, flowing robe with hugely gathered sleeves and a satin ribbon at the neck. I heard my mother's voice asking if I'd get much use out of it. Jamie's voice saying I could buy a nice nightgown. But then I wondered what Mike would say. And in a moment he was standing in front of me, carefully untying the ribbon, pushing the robe from my shoulders. And I thought that although he would probably never be able to do that, I should make the gown and robe anyway, an offering to memory, or to the future. I carried the fabric back down State Street to my car, all 8.5 yards of it, over $200 worth of silk, in a paper bag. I drove home and found a parking place in the shade. It was August now, and the cosmos my downstairs neighbors had planted looked weedy, the withered magenta blooms fading in front of the gray-brown fence. My apartment was still in the sun. I sat on the downstairs porch, on a wicker armchair left behind by a former tenant. The fast clicking of a bicycle suddenly slowed, and I looked up to see Tom, Victor and Anya's neighbor, swinging his long leg over the back of his bike. He leaned the bike against the front fence and came into the yard. "Bet you're surprised to see me here," he said. "Victor gave me your address." Poor Victor, I thought, even as I was wondering why Tom had wanted my address. "I have something for you. I've been meaning to come by for weeks." I couldn't imagine what he was talking about. "You have something for me? What? Why didn't you just give it to Victor?" He shook his head. "Strict orders to hand it to you personally." He climbed the porch steps and sat on the top one, unzipping his backpack. "Here," he said, and brought out a dog-eared white envelope. He tried to smooth it out, then gave up and handed it to me. "Oh, well, it got a little mangled, sorry." I examined the envelope. "What is it?" "Kilroy wanted me to give it to you. Remember Kilroy, from that night?" I nodded. "Well, he wanted me to give it to you. Sorry it took so long, but I've been working like a fucking dog this summer." After he got back on his bike and waved goodbye, I slid my finger under the flap of the envelope. Inside was a piece of lined yellow paper. "Sunday, 2 a.m., it said at the top. "Dear Carrie Bell, finally I know the reason for your sad eyes and silence, and I'm selfishly looking for forgiveness. The problem with reading minds is that you can get awfully close and still miss the essential thing. I hope Mike wakes to your vigilance and love soon, and that you'll be well together. Kilroy. P.S. Try pool." I thought of that evening back in June, Anya in the kitchen cooking, Victor towering over Kilroy in the living room, so offended by his questions that he finally stalked away. Kilroy, with his narrow body and sharp face, staring at me, summing me up. There had been a quietness to him, some kind of smooth, bland covering over a sharp watchfulness. The sense of an engine in there, running all the time. Something else, too, though. He was cocky at the same time that he mocked his own cockiness. I read the letter a second time, then I put it back in the envelope and put the envelope in my purse. I'd felt his eyes on me all through dinner that night. Studying me, it turned out. Wondering about me. The silk was like nothing I'd ever worked with before, slippery and so fluid it was almost as if it were alive, slithering from my table onto the floor, sliding off the deck of my sewing machine if I was careless when I pulled the needle out, if I didn't have my hands right there to coax it to stay. I made the nightgown first. It was basically two bias-cut panels, A-shaped but just barely joined along the sides. I finished the hem late one night and then hung the gown on a hanger and put it in my closet, where it would be the first thing I saw when I woke the next morning. During those days of sewing, I felt distracted a lot. At work, I'd suddenly come to myself, a book in hand, a wall of shelves before me, and I'd actually have to shake my head to get myself clear of whatever stage of the sewing I'd been at when I'd stopped the night before.
Victor shot me his usual looks of concern, and I gave him sad smiles. Let him think it was all just too hard, having Mike in the hospital. That was my problem. Of course, that was my problem. I knew that every minute, sewing or not sewing, with Mike or not, and he got lower and lower, sometimes barely registered my presence. One evening I arrived for my visit and found him not lying on his bed but sitting in his wheelchair, a first for after dinner, a heavy strap holding his torso in place. "Wow, you're up," I said. "I can't believe it." He gave me a look. "What?" "Isn't it ironic? I'm a low quad, and yet I'm up." A week ago, he'd reported that he'd heard one of the physical therapy assistants using the phrase low quad in reference to another patient with a relatively low cervical spine injury. I looked around the room. All the mayors were there, Mr. and Mrs. in chairs opposite the foot of Mike's bed, Julie and John Jr. on the floor to the side. "Hard day?" I said. "Just the usual." "You seem tired." "I am." Mr. and Mrs. Mayer exchanged a glance, and I moved closer to Mike.
"Are there too many people here?" I whispered. "Do you want me to go?"
"If you want."
"What do you want?"
Mike's face went livid, and he shouted, "Stop asking me what I want!" He stared at me with his eyes burning, his words bouncing off the hard surfaces of the room and keeping us both absolutely still. Finally, the color in his face began to drain away, and he said quite calmly, "Why do people keep asking me what I want? I want to walk out of here. Christ! I want to walk." Simon Rhodes called me one evening near the end of August, and we talked for almost 3 hours, the longest I'd spent doing anything but sewing in months. "So, what's new in the Carrie Bell saga?" he said. "Wait till you hear the latest in the Simon Rhodes saga." He told me about life in New York, about his problems with his boyfriend, about the big, dilapidated brownstone he shared with a bunch of Yale friends, about the Park Avenue law firm where he worked as a proofreader. It had the unlikely name of Biggs, Leper, Rush, Creighton, and Fenelon, but he said all the proofreaders referred to it as the Big Leper Rush. What he really wanted was to be an illustrator. I told him about Mike's sadness, about how difficult it was to watch, about the rare moments when some piece of his former self came through, when he joked with Stu or Bill, Ribbed Rooster, about Joan. I'd catch his eye and there'd pass between us a recognition of the fact that he didn't have any of that available for me right now. "It sounds hard," Simon said, and I was grateful. I could tell him anything and it would be okay, the words zooming away from Madison, safely gone just moments after I'd uttered them. Before we hung up, I said I wanted to pay for half the call, but he wouldn't hear of it. "Are you kidding?" he said. "This is the most fun I've had since I played Twister at Nicole Patterson's birthday party in fourth grade." I laughed, but I knew what he meant. Fun might not be the word, but there was something about talking to him that was deeply satisfying. It was nearly midnight, but I put on some shoes and went down to my car, the urge to move propelling me across the isthmus that divided the lakes and around Lake Monona, the big round darkness of it glinting with reflected bits of the half moon. I got on the Beltline heading west. I was coming around Middleton when I finally got off, and I slowed to wind through cul-de-sac land until I reached the strip of big, faceless restaurants that had been our destination so often, on countless nights when we'd been cruising too long and wanted pancakes or big, wide platters of French fries. I hadn't been that far west in ages. It was like a strange foreign land. I was about to head for home when I glanced across a nearly empty parking lot and saw a woman standing by herself under the front light of the alley, a ratty cocktail lounge I'd heard about but never been in. There was something familiar about her, something in the way she stood, but I couldn't figure out what. I pulled into a gas station and swung around so I could go back out the way I'd come. I drove into the alley parking lot, and then I saw. It was Lynn Fletcher, Jamie's younger sister. She was standing just in front of the entrance, one leg crossed in front of the other, wearing a short skirt and an oversized jean jacket. Her hair was big and disheveled, as if she'd just teased it and doused it with hairspray. I stopped in front of her and she glanced once at my car and then looked away. Reaching across the seat, I rolled down the passenger side window and called her name. She glanced at me again, this time stooping to look through the open window. Her hand flew to her mouth.
Carrie?
What are you doing here?
Nothing. Waiting for someone.
Come here, I said, motioning her to the car. She hesitated, then took a few steps closer to me.
Who are you meeting? I said.
A friend from work. The restaurant where she waitressed was nearby, I recalled, Spinelli's. I wondered how she was going to get into the alley, if she had a fake ID. Or maybe no one would card her, as she looked about 16, standing there in her too short skirt, big silver hoops hanging from her ears. She took a step closer.
Don't tell, okay?
Don't tell who? I cut the engine and after a moment leaned toward her and opened the door. Sit with me for a sec, I haven't seen you in ages. She looked toward the road, then shrugged and got into the car.
I mean, don't tell Jamie.
What are you up to?
I just have a date.
With? Just someone I met at work.
You mean a customer?
Jesus, do you really think that's a good idea?
It's fun.
Do a lot of the customers hit on you?
Carrie?
She gave me a hurt look.
They're just friendly.
I'll bet. She shrugged, tugging a little at her skirt.
Do you let these guys think you're 21?
She laughed and I realized that she'd had a drink or two already, that she was in fact on her way to being drunk. Lynn turned toward me with a giggle.
Carrie, don't tell, but I sometimes play this little game with them.
I let them buy me a couple of drinks, then I say I have to get home for my curfew or my parents will get mad and they just, like, freak. Your parents? How old are you? I said to this one guy a couple nights ago, I'm 16, just to see what he'd do, and I swear he had a heart attack. You're 16? I thought you were 22 at least. My daughter's 16. Guy gave me a 20 not to tell anyone.
Lynn, I stared at her. Jesus, are you kidding?
It's fun. It's stupid. Her eyes got big.
You're not gonna tell Jamie, are you? She'd tell my mother for sure. Promise me you won't tell, please.
I sighed.
Please?
Okay, I promise. But you promise you'll stop, all right? She settled her purse strap on her shoulder and tilted her head at me, her expression earnest all at once.
Don't worry, she said. I'm a big girl.
She lifted one leg and kicked the car door closed, then took a few steps backward until she was under the entrance light again. I had the next day off from the library, and when I woke up, I decided to sew all day. Just sew and sew, music playing loud, no room in my head for questions or thoughts. Just as I'd finished attaching the first sleeve to the robe, there was a knock at my door, followed by Jamie's voice from downstairs, calling up to see if I was home. I looked around the room. Why I didn't want Jamie to see what I was making was a question I hadn't posed to myself, but I knew I didn't. In a hurry, I set the robe down and started for the stairway where I could already hear her footsteps. Woman! She was about halfway up, and she didn't stop when she saw me. I was on my way by, so I figured I'd stop in. If I don't get my hair cut today, I swear I'll die.
Better get it cut, then.
I leaned against the wall in an effort to suggest that we could have our chat on the landing and then she could be on her way. She said,
I'm going to. They're having a special at that place near Hilldale.
She reached the top step and held out her palm for mine. Want to come? I touched my hair. I hadn't had it cut since the accident. The ends were dry and splitting. I shook my head. I'm broke. This was only half a lie, since I was feeling pinched from spending so much on the silk. She gave me an exasperated look.
Come on, put it on your credit card. It won't kill you.
I never used my credit card as a way of buying more than I could afford. My mother had warned me again and again about how quickly interest would build, how I'd end up paying double or more for everything I'd bought.
Sorry, I said. I can't.
Jamie turned a little, and just as I was thinking she might actually leave, she flapped her hand at me once and then stepped past me through the doorway into my apartment. I've got to pee, she said, and then she stopped in her tracks. It was a sight. Pieces of silk hanging from chair backs, my table littered with pattern pieces, pincushion, lengths of ribbon, my sewing machine sitting there with its little light bulb burning like a porch light on in the middle of the day.
What is going on here? Jamie said.
I've been sewing.
So I see, but the question is what? She advanced toward the table. Is this silk?
It's a nightgown.
My voice sounded dead as stone, and I tried again. It's kind of a combo nightgown and robe.
God, Carrie, and you didn't even tell me?
She reached for the robe, which I'd left next to the machine.
Don't!
I hurried past her to pick it up. Here, I'll show it to you. I forced myself to show her what I'd done so far, then I carried the pieces into my bedroom, took off what I was wearing, and put the gown and then the robe on, quickly pinning the second sleeve into place.
Totally amazing, she said from the doorway. You could go into business and make a ton of money. I'm serious.
Right, I said, although I was flattered.
You could.
How much did the material cost?
100?
150. Her eyes widened.
200?
She came over and felt the robe. Still, I bet you could charge 400 for the two pieces. Look at yourself. You look like some incredibly glamorous actress in an old movie. I turned and looked in the mirror.
Really?
Definitely. All you need is a cigarette in an ivory holder. Honeymoon City. Ironically enough. Her eyes met mine in the mirror and we looked at each other for a long moment.
Well, you never know, she said.
I do kind of know is the thing. She turned from the mirror and stared at me. I was shaky with the shock of having said it, and for a while I just stood there, my face hot, my heart thudding. Then I turned around, slipped the robe off, pulled the gown over my head, and got back into my t-shirt and boxers.